Blog Talk Radio.
Good it's morning, time everybody. For Driving Me Crazy, coming to you live from Beechtree Studios near beautiful Pinehurst, North Carolina. This is the only show where a husband and wife drive, talk cars and life, and still love one another each day. Here's John and Laurie. Or is it Laurie and John? Oh, take it away, you crazy kids.
Well, good morning, everybody. Today's Thursday, December 2nd. Unfortunately, despite the introduction, Lori and John are on vacation. I made a mistake, which I too often do, evidently. So it seems that they're already on vacation. I thought they were going to be going on vacation next week. So it goes. They should be away for at least a month and maybe a little bit longer. We're not exactly sure because they're just doing the world, it seems, and good for them. And, well, so today we're not going to have a Driving Me Crazy review of an automobile. So we'll move on to some other issues. And then it'll just be you and I, and we'll be talking about the latest stuff that's come to the forefront. So let's just move on. Oh, and just in case anybody does want to call into the broadcast, they can, of course. The number to reach us is 347-205-9201. So again, 347-205-9201. Only thing to remember is that while I'm reading every different prepared subject matter, to see the studio screen at the same time. So that becomes a bit of a problem. But every time I finish something, I'll check the studio screen to see in case anybody is called. All right, so there we go. Let's start off with what's happening. Well, the United States Supreme Court appears prepared to roll back abortion rights. It seems that the conservative-dominated Supreme Court appeared poised yesterday to roll back abortion rights in the United States by upholding a law in the southern state of Mississippi that would ban the procedure after 15 weeks. Hundreds of demonstrators gathered outside the imposing court in Washington as the nine justices heard 2 hours of arguments in the most pivotal abortion case to reach the nation's highest court in 50 years. Mississippi Solicitor General Scott Stewart urged the courts to uphold the state's 15-week ban and strike down the landmark cases that enshrined a woman's constitutional right to an abortion. While acknowledging abortion is a, quote, hard issue, end quote, Stewart argued that individual states should be allowed to set their own rules. Quote, when an issue affects everyone and when the Constitution does not take sides on it, it belongs to the people, he said. Excuse me. This court, quote, this court should overrule Roe and Casey and uphold the state's law. In a 1973 ruling, Roe versus Wade, by a 7-2 vote, held that access to abortion is a constitutional right until the fetus is viable outside the womb, typically from 22 to 24 weeks. In a 1992 ruling, Planned Parenthood versus Casey, the court upheld Roe and said states cannot impose an, quote, undue burden, end quote, on a woman's ability to get an abortion. Well, the law passed by the Republican-led legislature in Mississippi, a Bible Belt state, would ban most abortions after 15 weeks of pregnancy and make no exception for rape or incest. Should the Mississippi law be upheld, more than 24 other U.S. states are expected to seek to restrict abortion. The court is expected to render its decision in June. Well, at least 4 of the 6 conservative-leaning justices, including 2 nominated by Donald Trump, seemed receptive to overturning Roe versus Wade. So I hear that again. At least 4 of the 6 conservative-leaning justices, including 2 nominated by Donald Trump, seemed receptive to overturning Roe versus Wade. The 2 other conservatives, Chief Justice John Roberts and Neil Gorsuch, also a Trump nominee, appeared to favor a more cautious approach, upholding the Mississippi law while not going so far as to strike down Roe. The thing that is at issue before us today is 15 weeks, Roberts said. Attorney Julie Rickelman, arguing for the Center for Reproductive Rights, said this Mississippi law is, quote, flatly unconstitutional, end quote. Continuing, she said, for a state to take control of a woman's body and demand that she goes through pregnancy and childbirth with all the physical risks and life-altering consequences that brings is a fundamental deprivation of her liberty, Rickelman said. Rickelman argued for maintaining viability as the legal cutoff point for an abortion. Quote, without viability, there will be no stopping point, she said. States will rush to ban abortion at virtually any point in pregnancy. Solicitor General Elizabeth Proligar, representing the administration of President Joe Biden, said the court, quote, has never revoked a right that is so fundamental in so many Americans, to so many Americans. Well, the real world effects of overruling Roe and Casey would be severe and swift, Proligar said. Speaking to reporters after the court session, Biden said that Roe versus Wade is a rational position, and he will continue to support it. Well, Elena Kagan, one of the three liberal justices on the court, said abortion rights are part of the fabric of women's existence in this country, end quote. Justice Sonia Sotomayor, another liberal, said, quote, the right of a woman to choose, to control her own body, has been clearly set, end quote. Overturning Roe would give the impression the court is a political body, Sotomayor said. Quote, will this institution survive the stench that this creates in the public perception that the Constitution and its reading are just political acts, end quote, she asked. Amy Coney Barrett, who was nominated by Trump, asked repeatedly why adoption cannot be considered a viable alternative to abortion. Justice Brett Kavanaugh, also nominated by Trump, made it clear he believed access to abortion should be regulated by the states. Quote, why should this court be the arbiter rather than Congress, the state legislatures, state Supreme Courts, the people, Kavanaugh said. There'll be different answers in Mississippi, in New York, different answers in Alabama than California, he said. Why is that not the right answer? Well, Proligar, the Solicitor General, said, it was not the right answer because the court has recognized that abortion is, quote, a fundamental right of women, end quote, and it is, quote, not left up to state legislatures to decide whether to honor them or not. Alexis McGill Johnson, president of Parenthood Federation of America, a leading abortion provider, expressed concern for abortion rights after the court session. Quote, it was alarming, though not surprising, that the majority of the Supreme Court justices appeared prepared to allow politicians to control what we can do with our bodies, McGill Johnson had said. As the court heard arguments, hundreds of demonstrators gathered outside carrying signs reading, quote, abortion is murder, end quote, or on the other side, quote, abortion is health care, end quote. Public opinion polls have found most Americans believe abortion should be legal in all or most cases. But a segment of the population, particularly on the religious right, has never accepted the Roe versus Wade ruling and campaigned to have it overturned. So those are the sides, and we'll have to wait till June to find out what's going to happen. Now, very, very important as well. United States urges Russia to retract troops from Ukraine, from the Ukrainian border, and threatens sanctions. United States urged Russia yesterday to pull back its troops from the Ukrainian border. warning that a Russian invasion would provoke sanctions that would hit Moscow harder than any imposed until now. Quote, we don't know whether President Vladimir Putin has made the decision to invade. We do know that he is putting in place the capacity to do so in short order, should he so decide, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken had said. Should Russia follow the path of confrontation when it comes to Ukraine, we've made clear that we will respond resolutely, including with a range of high-impact economic measures that we have refrained from pursuing in the past. Blinken was speaking in the Latvian capital of Riga after conferring with foreign ministers from NATO and Ukraine on how to respond to what Kiev says is a Russian buildup of more than 90,000 troops near its border. He's expected to meet with Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov on Thursday. Russia seized the Crimean Peninsula from Ukraine in 2014, but denies aggressive intent in the current crisis and says it is responding to threatening behavior by NATO in Ukraine. The Kremlin said it feared Ukraine was gearing up to try to capture by force areas in the Donbas region in the east of the country controlled by pro-Russian separatists, something Kiev denies and accused it of, quote, very dangerous adventurism, end quote. It said that Russia could not take any steps to de-escalate because of a large concentration of Ukrainian forces close to the border. Ukrainian Foreign Minister Dmytro Kuleba said that Europe faced a critical moment and Russia was trying to shift the blame onto Ukraine. Quote, I would like again to officially state that Ukraine does not plan any military offensive in Donbas. This is Russian propaganda nonsense in order to cover up Russia's own preparations for a potential attack. Blinken declined to spell out what sanctions Russia might face and encouraged both Moscow and Kiev to return to diplomacy and revive a 2014 peace plan for eastern Ukraine. Russia has blunted the impact of sanctions imposed over its invasion of Crimea by reducing its borrowing on foreign financial markets and maintaining large currency and gold reserves. But the West has more potential leverage now if it were to target the newly built Nord Stream 2 pipeline under the Baltic Sea, through which Russia is keen to start pumping gas as soon as it gets the green light from a German regulator. Ukraine has centuries of shared history with Russia, and Moscow keenly resents its westward tilt since a pro-Russian president was ousted in a revolution in 2014. Its current aspiration to join both the European Union and NATO has made it the main flashpoint in Russia's deteriorating relations with the West. Putin said on Wednesday that Moscow wanted serious negotiations with the United States and its allies to extract legal guarantees that would rule out any further NATO moves to the east and the deployment of weapon systems close to Russian territory. A day earlier, the Kremlin leader said that Russia was ready with a newly tested hypersonic weapon in case NATO crossed its red lines, quote unquote, and deployed missiles in Ukraine. Well, Blinken told the news conference, quote, the idea that Ukraine represents a threat to Russia would be a bad joke if things weren't so serious. NATO itself is a defensive alliance. We're not a threat to Russia, end quote. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg rejected accusations the alliance was provoking Moscow with military exercises in the Black Sea. Quote, the problem with Russia, they are not transparent, that they have a very aggressive rhetoric and a track record showing they have used military exercises before as a disguise for aggressive actions against neighbors, he told the Reuters Next online summit. Russia said it had started regular winter military drills in its southern military district, parts of which border Ukraine, and that 10,000 troops had relocated to training grounds across the huge area. Its ally, Belarus, has also announced joint military drills with Russia on the Ukrainian border. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said that direct talks with Moscow were needed to end the war in the east, which Kiev says has killed more than 14,000 people. We must tell the truth that we will not be able to stop the war without direct negotiations with Russia. And today, this has already been recognized by all external partners, Zelensky told Parliament. Unbelievable. This is just insanity what the Russians are doing, but if God forbid if they get away with it, it's unbelievable. They literally ripped the Crimea, which belonged to Ukraine, ripped it from them a few years ago, and with no resolution to the whole issue, which is unbelievable. Now let's look at some other things. One second here. This you might find very, very interesting, and I had not heard about it until only yesterday. Tel Aviv, evidently in Israel, overtakes Paris and Singapore to become the world's expensive city. Can you imagine? I didn't. Israeli musician Shir Meir lives in a Tel Aviv hostel room with three friends, sharing a kitchen and bathroom with others as they struggle to get by in the world's most expensive city. We got to a point of despair, quote unquote, with housing prices, a 22-year-old said. There's no normal apartment for young people who are starting their lives in the city. Excuse me. Meir is among nearly 500,000 residents of the coastal metropolis who are dealing with skyrocketing living costs. Israel's cultural and economic capital is now more expensive than Paris, Singapore, Zurich, Hong Kong, and New York, according to an authoritative ranking compiled by the Economist Intelligence Unit. It climbed the list partly due to the strength of the national currency, the shekel against the dollar, as well as increases in prices for transport and groceries. Neighboring Syria's capital, Damascus, meanwhile, was listed the world's cheapest city to live in. Sitting on a bench on a central Tel Aviv shopping street lined with boutiques and gleaming renovated apartments, Janine Vosborg said she now avoided luxuries like restaurants and cafes. Quote, we live in overdraft, the 70-year-old said, pausing as a passerby begged her for money. Well, Vosberg, who runs the Israel Multiple Sclerosis Society, said some patients could not afford their drugs. But the former Manhattan resident advised she could not feel at home in any other Israeli city. Tel Aviv's ideas and the freedom and the consideration for everybody, regardless of age, gender, religious affiliation, it suits my way of thinking, she said. High cost of living has been a persistent issue in Tel Aviv. In 2011, a quote, tent revolution saw young Israelis furious. The sharp rises in rents, erect shelters on the upmarket Rothschild Boulevard in the heart of the city. A decade later, the tents are gone, but the soaring prices have remained. The protests had a temporary effect, quote unquote, said Asher Blass, former chief economist at the Bank of Israel. Tel Aviv's ranking this year is primarily due to the strong local currency, he said. Last month, the shekel reached a 25-year high against the dollar. As the cost of housing and other basics like groceries has increased, wage growth has been uneven. Quote, a lot more needs to be done in opening up competition for goods like agricultural produce to bring prices down, Blassett said. Now, rising costs are a windfall for some in Tel Aviv. At Rothschild Real Estate, which caters mostly to foreigners and wealthy Israeli tech workers, co-owner Eyal Fomansky said that high-end housing prices rose more than 10% in the past year. Whenever you put your chips, wherever you put your chips, it's a good bet, he said. Romansky said his clients were more worried about the strong shekel than the increased cost of daily goods. People from the United Kingdom to the United States, from Europe, do feel it's harder for them to buy, he said. There is only one Tel Aviv, and in this city there are very specific places people want to live, he added. For others, the appeal of Tel Aviv and its dizzying prices is starting to wane. At a central outdoor produce market, student Amy Scheffner said groceries were pricier than in her home city of Haifa. The 26-year-old aspiring actress said she saw living in Tel Aviv as a temporary big-ticket expense, similar to a trip abroad. You know, it's for a while. It's not for your whole life, she said. Very, very interesting. I had only heard about this yesterday on the BBC, a radio broadcast. This is very interesting because it may eventually come here to the United States as well. Austria and Germany see new restrictions on the unvaccinated as COVID-19 cases rise. As the number of cases of COVID-19 hit new record highs, governments in Europe and elsewhere are beginning to put targeted limits on the movements of the unvaccinated. Are these measures justified, or do they unfairly restrict people's freedom of movement? Austria is about to take perhaps the most decisive step. Parliament is expected to debate a measure this weekend that would mandate a lockdown for people who have not received 2 doses of the vaccine or recovered from the virus. The move is in response to a rapid rise in the number of cases. The aim is clear. We want on Sunday to give the green light for a nationwide lockdown for the unvaccinated, Austrian Chancellor Alexander Schallenberg told a press conference on Friday. A lockdown for the unvaccinated meant one cannot leave one's home unless one is going to work, shopping for essentials, stretching one's legs, namely exactly what we all had to suffer through in 2020, Schallenberg had said, to 3 national lockdowns last year. Well, the state of Upper Austria and Salzburg have already approved lockdown measures for the unvaccinated, slated to come into effect on Monday. The targeted lockdowns would be in addition to measures that came into effect on November 8, barring people who aren't fully vaccinated from entering many public places such as restaurants, bars, hairdressers, hotels, gatherings of more than 25 people, and perhaps most painfully for many, ski lifts. The new rules will be phased in over 4 weeks, during which proof of a first vaccination dose and a negative PCR test will be sufficient for access. Only 64% of the population in Austria is fully vaccinated, the lowest rate of any Western European country apart from Liechtenstein, according to the European Center for Disease Prevention and Control. European Union-wide average is 67%. Not everyone thinks the restrictions are warranted. There are people who think there is no justification for limiting freedom of movement, said Merten Regitz, senior lecturer at the Department of Philosophy at the University of Birmingham. That's in England. Others think the response is disproportionate, that the danger is not severe enough, that's one side of the coin. On the flip side is the argument that we have responsibilities toward those around us. Even though we have freedoms, we do not have the freedom to harm other people, Reglitz had said. That's why the state could be seen to be morally justified imposing restrictions on people. Essential is that the What's essential is that the response be proportionate. Imposing such restrictions in the summer, for example, when the rate of infection was low, would have been disproportionate, Regitz had said. Now that intensive care units are filling up, the calculation has changed. And this seems to be the conclusion of governments in other countries as well. On Monday, the German state of Saxony put so-called 2G rules in place, which effectively exclude people who choose not to be vaccinated from many areas of public life. Under the new rules, only people who are fully vaccinated who have recovered from COVID-19 in the past 6 months are permitted to eat inside restaurants or go to clubs or bars. A negative test will no longer get one through the door. Only children and those who have medical reasons for not being vaccinated are exempt from the new rule. Berlin will also adopt 2G rules on November 15, and Brandenburg, Baden-Württemberg, and Bavaria or Bayern are expected to follow suit. 2G rules are already in force in some districts where COVID hospitalizations are particularly high. Similar proposals are being discussed for adoption on a national level and, if approved, would come into effect later this month. Measures like these are not limited to Europe. New South Wales in Australia recently prohibited people over the age of 16 who are not fully vaccinated from visiting another person's place of residence, except in limited circumstances. And the Singaporean government will no longer foot the bill for the treatment of those who are unvaccinated by choice and catch the virus. To be honest, I like the Singaporean government's posture. And I think if you don't want to be vaccinated, okay, so you don't want to be vaccinated, but if God required treatment at a hospital, you won't get it. And you will no longer, and the government, rather, will no longer foot the bill for the treatment, which I think would scare the bejesus out of everybody, because predominantly the people who are becoming infected are the ones that haven't been inoculated, have never received a jab. Unbelievable. Just unbelievable. So those are some of the things that are going on around the world. And let's just cover some more issues, which I think you'll find interesting. Bear with me a moment. This is important, too. We think about what's going on in Myanmar. The Myanmar junta slams the United Nations delay on approval for its chosen envoy. Well, Myanmar's junta on Thursday slammed the United Nations decision to deny its chosen representative a seat at the world body and keep in place an envoy appointed by Aung San Suu Kyi's ousted government. Well, the committee responsible for approving nomination of ambassadors to the New York body met on Wednesday, but deferred a decision over the rival claims to Myanmar and Afghanistan seats, diplomats had said. The deferral keeps in place envoys appointed to the body by both governments before they were toppled by a coup in Myanmar in February and the Taliban's takeover in Afghanistan in August. And this decision does not reflect the reality on the ground and existence of our country, Myanmar junta spokesman Zaw Min Tun advised. We will continue submitting to the United Nations as usual according to diplomatic procedures and the right to representation in accordance with international and local laws, he added. The deferral leaves Kiao Mo Tun, appointed by Suu Kyi's government, in place as Myanmar's envoy. He made headlines shortly after the putsch or the junta, the three-finger salute of democracy. Protesters from his United Nations chair brazenly defying the junta's insistence that he no longer represents the country. In August, U.S. prosecutors said they had charged two Myanmar citizens in a plot to attack him. The junta has denied any involvement and chosen former soldier Aung Thurein as its envoy to the body. The Taliban in September asked the United Nations to accept its former Doha-based spokesperson Suhail Shaheen to succeed Ghulam Isakzai, a cabinet member of ousted President Ashraf Ghani. Isakzai continues to occupy Afghanistan's offices at the United Nations headquarters and even participated in a recent Security Council meeting in which he openly criticized the Taliban. But there was, quote, consensus, quote, unquote, within the Credentials Committee to delay the decision, and two diplomats advised on condition of anonymity. China, Russia, and the United States were in the same position, one of them said. The nine-member committee is due to submit its report next week to the General Assembly, which will be left to decide via a possible vote if its 200 members fail to reach a consensus, diplomats had said. Myanmar has been in turmoil since the military ousted Suu Kyi's National League for Democracy government, sparking huge democracy protests, which have triggered a bloody crackdown from the junta. the National League for Democracy lawmakers make up the majority of a shadow national unity government, quote unquote, which is working to overturn the military regime, which the junta has branded, quote, terrorists, end quote. Suki has been detained since the coup and faces a catalog of charges that could see her jailed for decades. Unbelievable, the stuff that goes on, huh? Now let's look at what's going on with the Holy See. Pope Francis accepts the Paris bishops, the Paris archbishop's resignation over, quote, ambiguous, end quote, relationship with a woman. Pope Francis has accepted the resignation of the Archbishop of Paris after he admitted to an ambiguous, quote-unquote, relationship with a woman in 2012. Archbishop Michel Aupetit said in a statement on Thursday that he offered to step down, quote, to preserve the diocese from the division that suspicion and loss of trust are continuing to provoke, end quote. The Vatican said in a statement that the Pope accepted Aupetit's offer and named Monsignor Georges Pontier to serve in the Archbishop's place. Aupetit, who had led the Paris Church since 2018, sent a letter to Paris, to Francis rather, offering to resign following a report in Le Point magazine saying he had a consensual, intimate relationship with a woman. Aupetit told Le Point he didn't have sexual relations with a woman. The article in Le Point relied on several anonymous sources who said they had seen a 2012 email Aupetit sent by mistake to his secretary. Aupetit denied being the author of the email. Roman Catholic prelates take vows of chastity at the time of the alleged relationship. Aupetit was a priest in the Archdiocese of Paris. Quote, I ask forgiveness of those I could have hurt and assure you all of my deep friendship with my prayers, Aupetit said in a statement. He said he was, quote, against me, end quote. In an interview last week with Catholic Radio Notre Dame, Aupetit said, quote, I poorly handled the situation with a person who was in contact many times with me, end quote, calling it a, quote, mistake, end quote. He said he decided no longer to see the woman after speaking with Cardinal André Vintois, the then Paris Archbishop in 2012. Only the Pope can hire or fire bishops or accept their resignations. At 70, Aupetit is 5 years shy of the normal retirement age for bishops. The Pope has refused to accept similar offers from other prelates caught up in scandal. The former Archbishop of the French city of Lyon, Cardinal Philippe Barbarin, offered to resign in 2019 after a French court convicted him of failing to report a pedophile priest. Francis initially refused Barbarin's offer, but later accepted it. More recently, German Cardinal Reinhard Marx, the Archbishop of Munich and Freising, offered to resign over the Catholic Church's catastrophic, quote-unquote, mishandling of clergy sexual abuse cases. Francis refused to accept it, and Marx remains in office. My God, there's so much stuff that goes on around the world, isn't there? Unbelievable. 1 second. I think you'll find this really interesting. Quote, we lost touch with empathy, end quote, Iraqi Oscar entry exposes the migrant tragedy on Europe's doorsteps. Well, after premiering at the Cannes Film Festival earlier this year, Haider Rashid's migrant thriller Europa has been selected as Iraq's contender for Best International Feature Film at the upcoming Academy Awards. Juan Fancat spoke to the Italian-Iraqi director about the humanitarian crisis at Europe's borders and his hopes for representing Iraq at the Oscars. A timely and chilling thriller, Europa, offers a vivid portrayal of the ordeal experienced by migrants desperate to enter fortress Europe. co-financed by the Iraqi and Italian culture ministries, among other supporters. It is the latest migrant-themed work by Rashid, whose father was forced to flee Saddam Hussein's Iraq in the late 70s, taking the very Balkan route that is the focus of his film. Europa is informed by first-person accounts of migrants who undertook perilous journey and in extensive interviews with non-governmental organization workers, human rights lawyers, and public officials. It follows a young Iraqi migrant named Kamal as he attempts to dodge brutal border guards and deadly migrant hunters at the Bulgarian border with Turkey. The film's probing, a handheld camera scours Kamal's bruised and exhausted body with relentless close-ups as he runs, leaps, crawls, and scurries up trees in a frantic race for survival. Young Migrants is played with mesmerizing intensity by Adam Ali, a British actor of Libyan origin with a slender build and a face from silent movies. Europa has appeared at film festivals across Europe since its international premiere at the director's, quote, fortnight in Cannes. Its director, Frans Venkat spoke to its director ahead of the film's Arab premiere at the Red Sea International Film Festival in Jeddah next week and its release in Iraqi cinemas on December 10. The film has won critical acclaim at European festivals, and how important was it to get the nod from Iraq too? So he said, I'm extremely honored to represent Iraq at the Oscars. Makes me feel welcomed and embraced by the country and even more proud of my mixed heritage. I've experienced exile vicariously through my father's experience. It has been more than 40 years since he fled Iraq, but it is somehow still part of our family life. Now I'm delighted to be doing something for the country, especially with Europa, which is a very culturally fluid film with support from both Europe and the Arab world. We made Europa as a sort of release from our own fears about the growing xenophobia and racism in Europe, but also to speak about what is happening to entire generations of Arab youth, of Iraqi youth, particularly those born after the regime of Saddam Hussein, who was toppled, who have grown up in extremely difficult and unstable circumstances. The film has been embraced by cultural institutions and filmmakers in Iraq, both for its subject matter and approach. They appreciate its innovative nature. It speaks about Iraq's youth in a new way in a country where everybody knows someone who has fled. I believe the decision to support the film financially and choose it to represent the country at the Oscars shows awareness of what is happening in Iraq and of the enormous need to build a better future for the country, especially for the young. Europa is the first joint Italian-Iraqi-Kuwaiti production. How significant is the Kuwaiti involvement in this project? Well, I think most people who were old enough at the time remember very vividly experiencing or watching the Gulf War unfold. I've had the opportunity to visit Kuwait several times and found great friends and collaborators there. I think it's very meaningful that 30 years after the war, the two countries have a good, peaceful relationship of cooperation and are working together on a cultural endeavor such as a film. Europa is now set for its Arab premiere after touring European festivals. How have audiences responded to your movie? Well, the most amazing experiences have come when screening the film for younger audiences, students especially. They engage in it in a way no other audience has. They are passionate about the character, the story, and the style of the film. Their enthusiasm gave us a lot of energy, hope, and some insights. It's not true that teenagers have no interest in art house, social, or political cinema. We just have to find a way to engage them. I feel that the choices behind this film, in terms of its immersive style, that is maybe reminiscent of some video games in terms of rhythm, but also in terms of focusing on a young character who is just like them, speak to young audiences, and make them eager to think and discuss. Had the European Union's border standoff with Belarus and the latest migrant tragedy in the English Channel off the coast of France given added urgency to your film? I think the film shows events that have pressing relevance, regardless of which border they take place on. I came up with the concept of the film in 2016, and 5 years on, the situation hasn't changed. If anything, it's even worse. It's a humanitarian crisis of enormous proportions that will last for decades if it is only dealt with as an emergency. It's a structural problem that most institutions don't really want to fix. We are all so used to hearing about it that it's become normality. A lot of people scream for or are against it, but it feels distant. We made Europa to try to shake people out of this, to make them experience how close it is and how random it is that these dramatic events are not happening to them. It's just a stroke of luck that should not be taken for granted. Europe's history teaches us that. From Poland to England, calls and attempts by civilians to push back migrants have become increasingly common. While politicians routinely talk of suspending or rewriting international law to keep asylum seekers at bay, what does this say about our society? He says, we have lost touch with the concept and the feeling of empathy, which I believe should be at the center of our society. It's a simple concept, he says, which is why I think politicizing the debate on immigration is the greatest gift to political forces based on populism. Immigration shouldn't be a political issue. It is a human issue and should be spoken about with realism and humanity. Quote, it is shocking to watch news of what is happening on the Poland-Belarus border and in the English Channel, as much as it was shocking to watch images of Haitian migrants being chased by the mounted border patrol near the Rio Grande on the U.S.-Mexican border. Of course, it recalls moments from the film. These are desperate journeys of survival against nature and violent pushbacks and attacks. Every day, there are lives at high risk across borders. It is an inhumane and criminal treatment. Well, the next question is, the tragic situation unfolding at Europe's borders is referenced, documented, sometimes manipulated by a variety of actors, including journalists, activists, and politicians. What is cinema's role in portraying this crisis? So he says, I think cinema can help give a different perspective, a more human point of view, giving viewers a taste of someone else's experience. Our aim with Europa was to put the audience in the shoes of someone who's trying to survive through a forest as he's chased by migrant hunters and attacked by border police forces, and give them the opportunity to ask themselves how much events sit with them. Cinema has reached a very mature time in its history, technically and artistically. It can have an impact on audiences, and I believe there is a responsibility for us or to use it as a purpose of human interest. Very, very interesting perspective, but I think it is still one-sided. I still believe that it is an imposition for people to try to break the Belarus into Poland border. They're not welcome by the Polish, and nor they need to be. Poland has fought for its freedoms through many, many centuries and is independent and relinquished the hold that Germany had on it, that Russia had on it, and so on and so forth. And they want their freedom. They fought for their freedom. They died for their freedom. They died from every part of their border. And people forget. Do you know how difficult it is? And people must recognize that, how difficult it is to inculcate people from a different background, a different language, possibly even a different religion, into a society which they don't appreciate? Why can't they fight for their own freedom in their own country? What's the problem? Tell me what the problem is. It's insanity that they think the only way to get by borders and imagine the costs from being smuggled out of Iraq and to go through all the Arab countries and eventually to come into southern Europe or Russia and Belarus and try to march into Europe. And let's look at what happened in the United States. Remember when the talk in the United States was always, well, we are strengthened by our diversity. Interesting, isn't it? We're strengthened by our diversity. But Poland is homogeneous. Germany is homogeneous. France is homogeneous. Italy is homogeneous. You've got a few people who've settled in and acclimated, and that's fine. There's no problem. No one wants them to go away. But for your own country, hey, they tried to do that in Egypt. That worked for a little bit, and somewhat it didn't. In Syria, they're still slugging it out, but nobody seems to care. The people there don't struggle. In Iran, there's a total uproar as well. There's no love for the administration there. In Iraq as well. Come on, this is insanity. Look at what's going on in Ethiopia. Look at what's going on in so many places. Interestingly enough, for example, the thing that Israel, for example, is going to take another 8,000 people from Ethiopia, and they're going to bring them to Israel. So what brings them, what permits Israel to say, hey, we want these people? Well, they're Ethiopian, but they also happen to have Jewish heritage, and they're black. So what? The thing that binds them to the Jewish nation is the fact that they are Jewish. That's it. You could be Jewish and be from Japan. You could be Jewish and be from India. You could be Jewish and be from anywhere in the world. But as long as you're a Jew, if you want to return to the Jewish state or you want to settle in the Jewish state, you're welcome. And that's the way it goes there. But there are very few other countries around the world that are willing to take people from any place. And I do remember there were times when there were people who had no relationship to Israel who wanted to come to Israel to escape whatever harm they would endure in their own country. But Israel couldn't accept them. There was no way to adopt them into the country. So it's just not done. There are people who are not Jewish who live in Israel, but not asylum seekers. They're not asylum seekers. So that becomes like one of the major issues there. Well, we only have a little bit more time. I'm only going to be with you till about 11 o'clock. Bear with me a moment. One second. There were other things I wanted to look at with you. Bear with me a moment here. One moment here. Okay, this I needed to touch on with you as well. Uganda and the Democratic Republic of Congo announced a joint operation against the Islamic State-linked militia. Ugandan troops crossed into the Democratic Republic of Congo on Tuesday as part of a joint operation against a notorious Islamist militia that both countries accuse of massacring civilians. The two countries announced that the operation began with morning artillery and airstrikes against the ADF armed group, which has risen to become the deadliest of many militias plaguing the Democratic Republic of Congo's east. So let me just see. This is a report. No, we won't be able to get this report. There was also a video of this, but we don't have access to it. Now, let me just look and see what else is going on. But that's the gist of it. And, okay, let me just look at something else. All right, bear with me a moment as we just have cover a couple of more things with you before we go. All right, 1 second. This is very interesting. I never expected this would happen. The loss of China events over Peng could go past 2022. Seems the suspension of all WTA tournaments in China, World Tennis Association tournaments in China, because of concerns about the safety of Peng Shuai, a Grand Slam doubles champion who accused a former government official there of sexual assault, could result in cancellations of those events beyond 2022, the head of the Women's Professional Tennis Tour told the Associated Press on Wednesday. We're hopeful to get the right place, but we are prepared. If it continues as it is, which hasn't been productive to date, that we will not be opening in the region, the World Tennis Association president and CEO Stephen Simon said in a video call from California. Quote, this is an organizational effort that is really addressing something that's about what's right and wrong, end quote. He said the move to put a halt on the tour's play in China, including Hong Kong, came with the backing of the World Tennis Association Board of Directors, players, tournaments, and sponsors. It is the strongest public stand against China taken from a sports body, and one that could cost the World Tennis Association millions of dollars. Peng dropped out of public view after raising the allegation about former Vice Premier Zhang Gaoli in a November 2nd social media posting that was quickly taken down by Chinese authorities. In the months since, Simon has made repeated calls for China to carry out an inquiry into the 35-year-old Peng's accusations and to allow the World Tennis Association to communicate directly with the former number one ranked doubles player and owner of titles at Wimbledon and the French Open. Quote, our approach to this and our request to the authorities are consistent, and they'll stay there. We definitely would like to have our own discussion with Peng and be comfortable that she's truly safe and free and has not been censored, intimidated, or anything like that, Simon told the Associated Press. We still haven't been able to have that conversation to have the comfort that we're seeing isn't being orchestrated to date. And the second element of that is that we want a full and transparent, without any level of censorship, investigation on the allegations that were made. China typically hosts about 10 women's tennis tournaments each year, including the prestigious season-ending World Tennis Association Finals, which are scheduled to be held there for a decade. The nation is a source of billions of dollars in income for various sports entities based elsewhere, including the World Tennis Association headquartered in St. Petersburg, Florida, the NBA, the National Basketball Association run out of New York, and the International Olympic Committee out of Lausanne, Switzerland. Simon said the suspension announced on Wednesday via a statement from him issued by the tour means that tournaments could still end up being staged in China if its government followed through with his request. If not, the events could be moved to other countries, as happened this year when the tour's Asian swing was called off because of COVID-19 concerns. The World Tennis Association finals, for example, were shifted to Guadalajara, Mexico last month. We haven't canceled as of yet, but we're prepared to get to that point, Simon said on the video call. And that will be a point of discussion on some point. Where do we get to cancellation? And is it 2022 only? Is it for the future? I mean, those are all questions that will come down the road. Beijing is set to host the Winter Games beginning on February 4, and the International Organization of IOC, I forgot the name now, President Thomas Bach said on November 21 that he spoke with Peng, a three-times Olympian, on a 30-minute video call, and that she appeared to be doing fine, quote-unquote. And this was reconfirmed in yesterday's call, the IOC said on Thursday, revealing that its officials held another video call with Peng on Wednesday. Our human and person-centered approach means that we continue to be concerned about her personal situation and will continue to support her. Once again, the IOC did not release a video or a transcript of the exchange, nor explain how the call was arranged. The IOC repeated on Thursday its policy of quiet diplomacy, dealing directly with sports officials, quote, which given the circumstances and based on the experience of governments and other organizations is indicated to be the most promising way to proceed effectively in such humanitarian matters, end quote. The European Union said on Tuesday it wants China to offer, quote, verifiable proof, end quote, that Peng is safe. A number of Chinese business people, activists and ordinary people have disappeared in recent years after criticizing ruling Communist Party figures or in crackdowns on corruption or pro-democracy and labor rights campaigns. A statement attributed to Peng 2 weeks and tweeted out by the international arm of Chinese state broadcaster CCTV included a retraction of her accusations. Quote, in good conscience, I don't see how I can ask our athletes to compete there when Peng Shuai is not allowed to communicate freely and has seemingly been pressured to contradict her allegation of sexual assault, end quote, Simon said in the release announcing the suspensions. Given the current state of affairs, he said, I am also greatly concerned about the risk that all of our players and staff could face if we were to hold events in China in 2022. Asked twice about the WTA suspension of China's tournaments and concerns about Peng Shuai's safety, Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesperson Wang Wenbin refused to address either of the issues. Quote, we are always firmly opposed to acts that politicize sports, end quote, Wang said in a one-sentence response to journalists at a daily ministry's briefing. In a tweet, the editor of hardline Nationalist Communist Party newspaper Global Times criticized the World Tennis Association for, quote, coercing Peng Shuai to support the West attack on Chinese system, end quote, like other Western social media platforms, Twitter is blocked in China. The U.S. Tennis Association commended Simon and the World Tennis Association, tweeting a statement that read, quote, this type of leadership is courageous in what is needed to ensure the rights of all individuals are protected and all voices are heard, end quote. International Tennis Federation spokeswoman Heather Bowler said that the ITF, I guess it's International Tennis Federation Board, would meet Thursday to discuss the matter. I applaud, I'm just not used to seeing ITF. I understand International Tennis Federation. Anyway, I applaud Steve Simon and the WTA leadership for taking a strong stand on defending human rights in China and around the world, end quote, women's tennis player pioneer Billie Jean King said. The World Tennis Association, WTA, has chosen to be on the right side of history in defending the rights of our players. This is yet another reason why women's tennis is a leader in women's sports, end quote. Concerns about the censoring of Peng's post and her subsequent disappearance from public view during hashtag Where is Peng Shuai into a trending topic on social media and drew support from tennis stars such as Serena Williams, Naomi Osaka, Roger Federer, Rafael Nadal, Novak Djokovic and Martina Navratilova. But news of the first hashtag MeToo case to reach the political realm in China has not been reported by the domestic media, and online discussion of it has been highly censored. Quote, I can only imagine the range of emotions and feelings that Peng is likely going through right now. I hope she knows that none of this is her and that we remain very proud of her extreme courage that she's shown through this, Simon told the Associated Press. But the one thing that we can't do is walk away from this, because if we're walking away from the key elements, which is obviously not only her well-being, but the investigation, then we're telling the world that not addressing sexual assault with respect to the seriousness it requires is okay, because it's too difficult and it's simply something that we can't help, we can't let happen. Very well expressed, and it's good that we heard it. One second. Omicron and the Delta spell are returning unpopular restrictions. So out of Paris, we hear that Greeks who are over age 60 and refuse the coronavirus vaccination could be hit with monthly fines of more than one quarter of their pension, a get-tough policy that the country's politicians say will cost votes but save lives. In Israel, potential carriers of the new Omicron variant could be tracked by the nation's domestic security agency in seeming defiance of a Supreme Court ruling from the last go-round. Weekly protests in the Netherlands over the country's 5 p.m. lockdown and other new restrictions have descended into violence, despite what appears to be overwhelming acceptance of the rules. With a Delta variant of COVID-19 pushing up cases in Europe and growing fears over the Omicron variant, governments around the world are weighing new measures for populations tired of hearing about restrictions and vaccines. It's a thorny calculus, made more difficult by the prospect of backlash, increased social division, and for many politicians, the fear of being voted out of office. Quote, I know the frustration that we all feel with this Omicron variant, the sense of exhaustion that we could be going through this all over again, British Prime Minister Boris Johnson said on Tuesday, 2 days after the government announced that masks would be mandatory again in stores and on public transportation and required all visitors from abroad to undergo a COVID-19 test and quarantine. We're trying to take a balanced and proportional approach. New restrictions or variations on the old ones are cropping up around the world, especially in Europe, where leaders are in pains to explain what looks like a failed promise that mass vaccination would mean an end to widely loathed limitations. People need normality. They need families. They need to see people, obviously safely, socially distancing. But I really think this Christmas now, people have had enough, said Belinda Story, who runs a stall at a Christmas market in Nottingham, England. In the Netherlands, where the curfew went into effect last week, mounted police patrol to break up demonstrations against the new lockdown, which is among the world's strictest, but most people appeared resigned to rush through errands and head home. The only thing we can do is to listen to the rules, follow them, and hope it's not getting worse. For me, it's not a problem. I'm a nurse. I know how sick people get, said Wilma Van Kampen. In Greece, residents over 60 face fines of 100 euros, $113 a month, failed to get vaccinated. The fine will be tacked onto tax bills in January. About 17% of Greeks over 60 are unvaccinated despite various efforts to prod them to get their shots, and 9 in 10 Greeks currently dying of COVID-19 are over 60. I don't care whether the measure will cost me some extra votes in the elections, Prime Minister Kyriakos Mitsotakis said on Wednesday after lawmakers passed the measure. Quote, I am convinced that we are doing the right thing, and I am convinced that this policy will save lives. Employing a carrot instead of a stick, Slovakia's government is proposing to give people 60 and older a 500 euro, that's a $568 bonus if they get vaccinated. In Israel, the government this week approved resuming the use of controversial phone monitoring technology to perform contact tracing of people confirmed to have the Omicron variant. Israeli rights groups have decried the use of the technology as a violation of privacy rights, and others have noted that its accuracy in indoor places is flawed, leading to large numbers of people being wrongly flagged. The Supreme Court earlier this year issued a ruling limiting its use. We need to use this tool in extreme situations, and I am convinced we are in that kind of situation, Justice Minister Gideon Sa'ar told Israeli public broadcaster Kan this week. In South Africa, which alerted the World Health Organization to the Omicron variant, previous restrictions, including curfews and a ban on alcohol sales. This time, President Cyril Ramaphosa is simply calling on people to get vaccines, quote, to help restore the social freedoms we all yearn for, end quote. Germany on Thursday followed Austria's lead and locked down the unvaccinated, excluding them from non-essential stores, cultural and recreational venues. The legislature is expected to take up general vaccine mandate in coming weeks. German Chancellor Angela Merkel said the measures were necessary because hospital risks are becoming overloaded. The situation in our country is serious. Infections have again topped 70,000 in a 24-hour period in Germany. Officials have also agreed to require masks in German schools, impose new limits on private meetings. In the United States, there is little appetite in either political party for a return to lockdowns or strict contact tracing. Enforcing even simple measures like mask wearing has become a political flashpoint, and Republicans are suing to block the Biden administration's get vaccinated or get tested requirement for large employers. President Joe Biden, whose political fare may well hinge on controlling the pandemic, has used a combination of pressure and urgent appeals to induce people to get their first shots or a booster. Also, the administration is working toward requiring that all air travelers to the United States be tested within a day before boarding their flight instead of the current 3 days. But Biden has said that the U.S. will fight COVID-19 and the new variant, quote, not with shutdowns or lockdowns, but with more widespread vaccinations, boosters, testing, and more, end quote. If people are vaccinated and wear the masks, there's no need for the lockdowns, he added. The rise of the new variant makes little difference to Mark Christensen, a grain buyer for an ethanol plant in Nebraska. He rejects any vaccination mandates and doesn't understand why it would be needed. In any event, he said, most businesses in his corner of the state are too small to fall under the regulations. If they were just encouraging me to take it, that's one thing, Christensen said, but I believe in freedom of choice, not decisions by force. Chile has taken a harder line since the emergence of Omicron. People over 18 must receive a booster dose every 6 months to keep their pass that allows access to restaurants, hotels, and public gatherings. And Chile never dropped its requirement to wear masks in public, probably the most common renewed restriction around the world. Excuse me. Dr. Madhukar Pai of McGill University School of Population and Public Health in Canada said that masks are an easy and pain-free way of keeping transmission down, but that cheap at-home tests need to be much more widespread in both rich and poor countries. He said both approaches give people a sense of control over their own behavior that is lost with a lockdown and make it easier to accept the need to do things like cancel a party or stay inside. Pai said requiring boosters universally, as it is essentially the case in Israel, Chile, and many countries in Europe, including France, will only prolong the pandemic by making it harder to get first doses to the developing world. That raises the odds of still more variants. Only come up when a system is failing, he said. We do it when the hospital system is about to collapse. It's the last resort that indicates you have failed to do all the right things. That's not how lockdowns are seen in communist China, which allows little dissent At each new outbreak, entire cities are sealed, and sometimes millions of people undergo mass testing. In the strictest lockdowns, people are forbidden to leave their homes, and groceries are brought to their door. So far, China hasn't seen the need for new restrictions in response to the Omicron variant. The head of China's Center for Disease Control's Epidemiology Unit, Wu Zunyu, said Omicron, for now, poses a manageable threat, and no matter what variant, our public health measures are effective. So that's the story. Again, this one from Associated Press coverage. So that's the story for us. And that'll be the end of our broadcast day with you today. So bear with me a moment as I go back to our studio screen. And thank you for being with us. Tomorrow's Friday. So because it's Friday, we're going to speak to former Mount Vernon Mayor Richard Thomas, and we're going to speak to Nader Sayers, the Assembly member representing Assembly District 90, which is comprised of Yonkers. So that's our story here. Thanks for being with us. All the best to you. Stay healthy. Do wear your mask. That's the least one can do. Anyway, so that's the story. Goodbye and good day. Bye.